First of all, can I welcome you all to the Global Strategy Forum debate, our first one in May, and I hope that you will find it as interesting as I personally think it's going to be. I think we have a fascinating subject, one which I fear we will probably not do justice to in the hour that we have ahead of us, but if we are at the end of it, we feel that it's worth doing again. I hope that we'll be able to have another occasion when we can carry the debate forward. But thank you very much for coming. I'm going to run this in the normal way that we do here. We've got one panellist who at the moment hasn't arrived, on a train down from Scotland, which has been delayed. If he does arrive, the pattern will be that each of my panellists will speak for about 6 minutes, and if we can try and keep it reasonably to that, I will then have an interactive period when the panel can take up matters between themselves which have arisen out of their presentations, and I will then open it to the floor. And as usual, I intend to finish at 2 o'clock, so that those of you who do have meetings to go to, and I'm afraid one of my parliamentary committees is meeting at 2 o'clock, we can all get away sharpish and make sure that we get back to the other work that we have to do today. We're very lucky with the panel that we've managed to bring together today, because I think that we have a wealth of experience here in what is an increasingly complex but important topic. First of all, we have Lord Fraser of Carmarthen on my left, who was a Member of Parliament, is now a Member of the House of Lords, was a Scottish law officer and the Minister for Trade in the last Conservative government. He is at the moment the chairman of the Anglo-Azeri Society and the British Kazakh Society, and he has, again, personally, a lot of experience in the area that we're going to be discussing today, so I'm delighted that he is with us. Then we have Emmett Oguchi, who is the director for BG Energy Holding Group, and is also an expert in international government and corporate affairs. He was with the OECD, leading the Global Forum on International Investment and Regional Outreach Programmes, and he covered China and Asia Pacific for the IEA from 1994 to 2000. He was a career diplomat in Ankara, Beijing, Brussels and Paris before that, and he is an expert on economic, energy and commercial diplomacy matters. He occasionally lectures in Dundee and also, I think, at the LSE on Turkey and China, India, Eurasia, Russia and the Middle East, with a focus on energy, geopolitics, investment strategies, economic and trade diplomacy. So I don't think I have to persuade you any more that he really does know this subject, and we look forward to hearing from him in a moment. Then again, on my near right, we have Dr. Shamil Yenikeyev, who's a research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, and he's an associate, senior associate member at the Russian and Eurasian Studies Centre at St. Anthony's College, Oxford. In the 1990s, he worked in the Russian Parliament as an advisor to the chairman of the subcommittee for the organisation of a state authority system in Russia. He's also been involved with a number of consulting companies specialising in the Russian oil industry and regional development. And his current research focuses on the political economy of the oil and gas sectors of Russia and Kazakhstan, with an emphasis on economic policy. So again, we have somebody who really does know his subject, and I'm sure we are going to have a very interesting debate today. The panellist who is missing is John Roberts, who I hope will arrive. He's an energy security specialist with Platts, the world's leading independent source of energy information, and his latest study, Pipeline Politics, the Caspian and Global Energy Security, is due to be published halfway through this year by the Royal Institute of International Affairs. He is, as many of you will know, a frequent commentator on global energy issues on BBC television and radio. I hope that he will make it, but he has let us know that his train was badly delayed, I think, by an accident on the line, so he's not trying not to get here. He's doing his best to be with us before we are through. If he doesn't make it, I will then try and extend the interactive period between our panellists in the middle. But without more ado, before we need to get down to the business, I'm going to first of all call on Mehmet Oguchi to open up and tell us his thoughts on this important topic for 6 minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for the invitation, and also asking the impossible task of discussing what we are set to discuss here. When I look at the title, three or four sub-teams, politics, pipelines, Central Asia, European energy security, all of them to be discussed in 5 minutes. So I will hope that I will use from John Roberts' time if he doesn't turn up. Yes, before perhaps we move to this subject, it might be useful to set the scene a little bit on what's happening globally. Because over the past decade or so, we are witnessing tectonic changes in world energy. And you have probably slides to be distributed about it, since we don't have the presentation facility here. You will see that there is a new global energy order in the making. Based on the current trends, energy demand around the world will be rising, according to IEA, by about 55% between now and 2030. And most of this incremental demand growth will come from countries like China and India. Also, the projections show that our future is still fossil fuel-based future, although we have high hopes for alternatives and renewables. For Europe, for example, currently I think it's about 66 to 7% of the total energy demand met by renewables. By 2020 it will be another 4%, so not exceeding 10% overall. And since Europe will continue to be heavily dependent on energy imports, and so the energy security issues will continue to figure prominently in our picture. Also, there is a changing dynamic in the international energy system, with countries like China and India transforming what we traditionally know, the energy system. And just one figure might perhaps help, or two figures might help to understand better the gravity of the problem we will be facing. Every day, I was told that 1,900 cars are joining the Beijing traffic. And if the current trends continue, China will be importing something like 13 million barrels per day of crude oil by 2030. This is much more than the Saudi total production today, and India is not in a better position. The other story is that resource nationalism is on the increase. Resource countries are asserting themselves more aggressively than they used to do. If you look at the headlines in the world media, you will see that. We don't need to discuss more on that. So there's a need for new forms of partnership between international oil corporations and national oil corporations. Seven Sisters probably might be leaving their place to PetroChina, Petrobras, Gazprom, Petronas. So there's a new type of partnership and new actors appearing on the energy scene. And supplies are getting tighter as the demand grows fast, and there is a mismatch between the two. And again, IEA calculates that between now and 2030, there is a need to invest more than $21 trillion in energy infrastructure, and we don't see this happening. So this is quite worrying in terms of easing supply constraints. So coming to Central Asia, why Central Asia matters for Europe especially and for the world at large. I think a slide here that you will see about Gazprom's production projections might provide some of the answers. If from 2011 onwards Yamal investment is not moving ahead and Gazprom is failing to produce more gas, and we are expecting a serious decline of production in Russia, and Russia also now heavily depends on Central Asia, which used to be former Soviet Union's gas tank, and in order to meet its commitment to the European markets, 95% of Gazprom gas moves to European markets. The rest is shared between Turkey and some of the Far Eastern regions. Therefore, Central Asia figures quite prominently, not only for us, but also for Russia, and we will see also for China and South Asia. When I first joined the diplomatic service dealing with energy matters in the West, these countries were not only istans, they didn't know how to pronounce Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan. It was quite difficult. But today, the diplomats, financiers, engineers, PR agencies, whoever you look for, they are in the grab for getting some handle in that region. And for us, Central Asia is important, and Caspian also is quite important, because it's set to become an important source of oil and gas for EU member countries and Asian countries as they seek to diversify to secure supply and also avoid over-reliance on any single country. In terms of oil, it is Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, and in terms of gas, it is Turkmenistan that we need to reckon with. And Turkmenistan currently produces something like 67 billion cubic meters a year of gas, and this year it will be 80, and if the new investments come on stream, this ratio will grow further. And Russia historically was the only outlet for Turkmen gas through Central Asia Center gas pipeline, but now increasingly we have other outlets, and Chinese one are under consideration. By the end of 2009, the Turkmen-Kazakhstan-China gas pipeline will be operational. Perhaps it may not be receiving the full capacity by 2013, but definitely it is on the move, including some supplies committed to this pipeline. And then Iranian pipeline was the first non-Russian outlet for Turkmen gas, currently about 6 to 7 BCM. It's a small pipeline draw, and there has been some difficulties in terms of pricing, which we might discuss later on perhaps, but they resolved the problem by paying almost the same price as Gazprom is paying. And then, of course, Trans-Caspian pipelines, which have been on the drawing board for so long. And I remember that in the early 90s, Blue Stream came and killed Trans-Caspian gas pipeline project at that time. Because for Russia, as we will discuss perhaps in this panel, gas supply leaving this region in whatever direction, east, west, north, south, is critically important. And it's not only a matter of economics, it's also a matter of foreign policy and geopolitical issue. And so currently what we see with regard to Nabucco part, if I say a few words before I conclude, otherwise I know Chairman will stop me, and is that there is a serious synchronization problem. So we know the demand. European Union will be needing at least 300 billion cubic meters of gas by 2030, and desperately needs a fourth artery in addition to Russia, Norway, and North African routes. And if they open a fourth artery through Turkey, this might reduce the reliance on Russia. This might also bring fresh volumes to the European market, desperately needed. And therefore, gas is more important than oil in many respects, which is a fungible commodity. And in Nabucco, as I said, there is a synchronization problem. Supply is not defined yet. There is a lot of talk about Azeri gas, providing the initial volumes of 6 to 8 BCM, and then perhaps the second phase of Shah Deniz might provide the rest, and the Turkmen gas, all of them are ifs, so many assumptions, but if you look at the Turkmen promises, it's better than perhaps during the Turkmen Bashir Niyazev period, when he signed hundreds of MOUs with almost every country visiting his palace. But now we have a more serious leadership, but still the current gas capacity of Turkmenistan may not be sufficient to feed Russia, because Russia has agreements with Turkmenistan up to 90 BCM. And then China, 30 BCM, Iran, 6 to 7 BCM, Trans-Afghan-Pakistan pipeline, which seems to be a pipe dream at the moment, but it is also a project kept alive by feasibility studies from Asian Development Bank. And in view of that, how to get this gas east of Caspian to Europe is a huge undertaking, and Europe hasn't even resolved the transit problems involving Turkey and other six transit countries. So we are facing quite a serious problem ahead of us. First, without talking the geopolitics and the Caspian legal dispute issues. But I will stop perhaps here and leave more to discuss during the question and answer session.
Thank you very much indeed. That's a real triumph of summarising a very large subject in a very short period of time. Thank you. I'm now going to call on Lord Fraser to give us his view on this subject.
Thank you very much, Michael. I think I'm probably the only person in the room who's not delighted to see John Roberts here joining us, because the last time that we discussed this subject, I think we fundamentally disagreed on one particular proposition. I will ride my hobby horse very briefly, and that is, I think there are now three commodities in the oil and gas world. There is oil, there is gas through a pipeline, and there is LNG. Because I think LNG is moving towards a state of fungibility which is very similar to oil. So if you were taking LNG from Nigeria, say, up the Atlantic, and the price is better in Europe than it is in the United States, you simply instruct the skipper to go that away. And I think that fundamentally alters things. And John disagreed with me, interestingly, on this point, not so much that there was an absence of facility in the producing nations to have made, put together compressed LNG, but there were an inadequacy of provision in areas of need. And I think that was why he disagreed about its opportunity for fungibility. I'm delighted to be on the platform as well, because some time ago Professor Emeritus Robert Mabrow and I were slightly bored at a meeting, and we put together a letter suggesting that it would be correct now to remove the Department of Energy from DBIR, or DTI as I still call it, and to have a separate department again, because energy supply was such an important issue. And I'm absolutely astonished to discover, as we put together this letter on the back of an envelope during a boring meeting, that it has now become official policy for Oil and Gas UK to separate these two out. And our political colleague Liam Fox has always said he would go one step further and say the appropriate place to put energy is along with defence. So it's becoming a very, very important issue around the world, and particularly in the United Kingdom. And I didn't mean it very seriously at the time, but after the events of Thursday and Friday, I'm beginning to think that this might be a rather more realistic prospect than I had imagined. What it might appear to some people is that pipelines in Central Asia are a matter of intense interest to those in the energy sector, but it is not of greater or wider significance. I would fundamentally disagree with that. I think the way that pipelines are set about in Central Asia is of geopolitical importance, and of global geopolitical importance. The Windsor Energy Group had a very good paper on this some years ago, which was argued about in Almaty. But basically, because of the former Soviet Union, all the pipelines in Kazakhstan have hitherto moved northwards into Russia to feed the Russian market. The world is changing now, and Russia has not been particularly sympathetic to the idea that there should be a major pipeline going from Kazakhstan into China. I think they're wrong on that, but they have been difficult about that in the past. And the only way you can move oil from Kazakhstan to China is by train. And as you get to the border, the gauge on the railway changes. And so you've got to move your oil from this train to that train. It's as simple as that. And that was quite clearly an important decision taken many years ago, long before I was born, when Russia was concerned about the invasion of its state by Nazi Germany. So it changed its gauge quite deliberately to make sure that German troops couldn't move in into Russia as simply as it did. But apart from that pipeline going to China, which I think is very important, I would have thought also, mention has already been made of the Turkmenistan gas pipeline, I would have thought there was a very real opportunity to move both oil and gas into Iran, which rather curiously has a natural excessive supply over demand in the south, but actually in the north of Iran there is a shortage, and it would make sense to that. But you've got to be pretty brave if you take on both Russia and America over taking gas or oil into Iran in significant quantities. And the third difficulty that I think is confronting Kazakhstan and has its geopolitical significance is, as you will all be aware, that for many years there's been a dispute about what is the status of the Caspian. Is it a lake or is it a sea? If it is a sea, then you go out to your territorial waters, the limits of it. You could work that out pretty quickly. If it is a lake, then everybody owns the seabed, and it's a lot of complications about that. There has never been a proper opportunity to get people to agree that on a multilateral basis in the Caspian. So there are a series of bilateral treaties around the Caspian. I regret that I don't have enough Russian to be able to, certainly not enough Russian to look through a treaty. But there is a bilateral agreement between Russia and Kazakhstan, which concedes that they will both take territorial waters as the basis on which to do it. But there's no status in international law, it is simply the basis of a treaty. But I'm told in the small print of that treaty that what you will find is that a pipeline can only be built across the Caspian with the agreement of the Russians. And I would be surprised if they are yet prepared to see that done. That is the way it has been put together. And while I think it's a fascinating subject to consider, my short point, which I hope people will take away from this meeting, is I believe it has very considerable geopolitical consequences for the whole world.
Thank you very much, Lord. There's another perspective, which I'm sure we'll want to explore a little. I'm delighted that John Roberts has now arrived from his difficult train journey. John, in your absence, I introduced you already preparation for you arriving. As you know, we're looking to be around 6 minutes in our presentations. Okay. I've been a little bit more flexible and generous in both the ones that have gone before. That will probably be at the expense of the interactive part, but if you can keep your remarks reasonably within that period. And thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Very simply, what you've heard about oil and gas is, broadly speaking, correct. Oil is a problem, but it's a global problem that's going to be solved globally, and basically the rich countries are going to do all right. They can buy their way out of trouble. The problem is gas, because gas remains essentially a bilateral business. Not only is it bilateral in pipelines, it's also, to a very large extent, because of the length of investment and the extent of investment, bilateral in the case of LNG. You have one set of investments going into liquefaction plants, you've got another set of investments going into the tanker business, you've got a third set of investments going into regasification. They are usually bound together, and the spot trade in LNG, although growing, and that's an important point, is still subordinate to the bilateral trade. Also, you have the political realities. A country like Qatar is going to split its output in three very distinct ways. The Far East, because that's the area that most needs the gas and has helped come up with much of the money for it. The United States, partly because of the ownership, the one-third ownership of ExxonMobil and various partners in LNG facilities in Qatar. And thirdly, Europe, because that's a major market. But it will balance the market. It's not going to fundamentally allow one market to outbid any other. It simply, politically, cannot afford to do so. And what happens to Qatar applies to a certain extent. extent to the other major LNG producers. Why is Turkmenistan important? Well, I'm ashamed to say that after 15 years, I only came up with the answer 2 days ago. If you look at it, it's actually, I think, and I do stand to be corrected, the only major energy exporter that is essentially dependent on gas for its export revenues. There are others, Russia, Norway, Qatar, that are both major gas and significant oil producers. But in proportion to export earnings, nothing figures like the export earnings do for Turkmenistan's balance of payments. It really is unique in being a country that has gas and that wants to export it. That's why the world looks to the Caspian. Kazakhstan produces oil and gas as a sideshow. Gas will remain important in a global context for Kazakhstan, but not nearly as important as oil. But Turkmenistan, how do we get to it? Well, you can get to it across the Caspian or round the Caspian through Iran, though I think the Iranian route is out simply because of the practicality of US third country sanctions, whether or not they are legal. And of course, in international law, they are not legal, but they are there de facto. Is there a route across the Caspian? I'm not so worried about the status of the Caspian issue. Frankly, it doesn't matter whether it's a sea or a lake, it's a question of power politics. Lakes can be divided. The Great Lakes of Central Africa, the Great Lakes, indeed, of North America are, in cases, divided. Indeed, Russia itself has a divided lake, which it shares with North Korea. So you could do that if there is the political will for it. The real question is, will Russia let you build a pipeline? It has no right in treaties to do so, but it can probably summon a fair degree of power politics to try to prevent it happening. So you are as well looking at alternative options. These can include conceivable possibilities that Marathon of the United States has been reported to be thinking about, which is a form of highly cheapened, small-scale LNG, still seems to my mind to be a somewhat peculiar one given the high cost of LNG generally. Compressed natural gas is being explored. Alternative pipelines through Iran, or even indeed doing the pipeline at all if Russia becomes in some way moderately cooperative. What do I mean by moderately cooperative? It could do so in one of a number of ways. It can sign up to the Energy Charter Treaty and the Transit Protocol. When it signed the Energy Transit Treaty, it says it will abide by it in practice. We're not sure whether it will, and it loads the Transit Protocol with a vengeance that is in fact counterproductive to its own interests. But it's offering to pay Turkmenistan close to market prices for Turkmenistan's gas. If that is the case, it is in a very strong position to grab the gas on terms that force it itself into some kind of a revolution, i.e. starting to charge its own people higher prices, considerably higher prices for its own gas. Because after all, it makes no sense to buy gas abroad for $200 per 1,000 cubic meters if you're going to sell it to your own people at a projected maximum of 120, 125 in 2011. You lose too much. So we may yet see reform, particularly under Medvedev, but I wouldn't count on it. And that's why you need political pressure to explore whether you can get a pipeline. That raises the question, you can get it through Georgia, you can get it through Azerbaijan to Georgia. What you do in Turkey remains a vital question. There is no answer coming out of the Turkish government that currently appears helpful. And this is extremely worrying. 4 years ago, there was one issue on which Turkey and the EU were totally in sync, and that was energy. Today, they could not be more diametrically opposite, except that it's not quite true. Since Turkey is not merely at outs with the EU on energy, it's at outs with Russia, it's at outs with Azerbaijan, it's not on terribly good terms with Iran, despite having an MOU last summer. In other words, Turkey is in a very odd position indeed, and it really, perhaps of all the countries that we deal with in transit, is the one that most needs to rethink its transit policy. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. And now our final panellist is Dr. Shamil Yenikeyev. I'm going to ask him to complete the presentation.
Yeah, I just wanted to focus on two key issues. Issue number one is gas volumes available from Central Asia, from Central Asian producers. I mean, you can build numerous pipelines, but if you cannot secure enough gas volumes, these pipelines will be useless. Second issue is the issue of export markets, is the issue of competition between the consuming nations in the times of the seller's market. And here what we see in relation to Central Asia is Russia got there first, China got there second, and Europe is hoping to secure gas volumes from Central Asia, but it's actually boosting competition between Russia and China for energy resources in Central Asia. And it's also, in a way, making an impact on gas prices in that region as well, which I think is very important for Europe. In terms of pipelines, like I said, if there are not adequate volumes available, these pipelines are useless. And here I would like to say a few words about Turkmenistan, which may not be able to secure adequate gas volumes for both Russia and China. And in this respect, Europe will not be able to get anything from that particular producer. In terms of Kazakhstan, it's a slightly different story, because in Kazakhstan, Kazakhstan is the major transit hub for, the main transit hub for Central Asian gas. And the reason why the Kazakh story is complicated is because of several issues. Issue number one is oil production versus gas production. Kazakhs need to re-inject gas in order to produce larger volumes of oil. If they go for if re-injection is not as successful as they were hoping initially, then there will be more gas available for both domestic and export markets. Second issue is gas utilization and state policies in this respect. Kazakhs have various ideas about how they're going to utilize their gas. One of the key issues here is use of gas for domestic consumption, especially in southern part of Kazakhstan. Kazakhs are very preoccupied with their own energy security, and they don't really want to be dependent on Uzbeks for gas supplies, which are imported into Kazakhstan from Uzbekistan, into southern Kazakhstan from Uzbekistan. Also, Kazakhs have ideas for development of their own petrochemical industry, and they would like to use gas as the key driver for that industry. Another important issue when it comes to Kazakhstan is state policies in relation to international companies operating in Kazakhstan, because oil volumes and gas volumes are mainly produced by international consortia operating which are developing countries' main hydrocarbon fields. This will affect infrastructure investment. We'll see how the relationship with international companies will develop. They have not always been easy, and there were some complications, and Kazakhs are not often are not happy with the way those companies are operating. At the same time, those companies often find it uneasy to operate in Kazakhstan, and hopefully Kazakhs and IOCs operating in that region will find some kind of solution for their differences. Another important issue is domestic gas prices, and the issue which I've already outlined, domestic and external gas prices, because gas prices in many Central Asian countries, not only Kazakhstan, are heavily subsidized. And if some Central Asian producers put, for example, meters on domestic consumers, they could probably boost gas output But again, this is very much a political decision and not an economic one. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. I think we've had a very interesting selection of presentations, quite a good deal of agreement on the problems, rather less agreement on perhaps some of the solutions to them and indeed the interpretations of them, and that might be something we want to explore a little. I'm now going to give the panel a chance to raise anything where they agree or have a question from what's been said, and after we've done that for a little, I'll open it up to the floor. Yes.
Thank you, Michael. I fully agree with Lord Fraser that pipelines has significant geopolitical significance and value. This has always been so, because energy and geopolitics cannot be treated in isolation from one another. Throughout the history, we know the reasons for wars, conflicts, and where we are. Of course, companies are striving for the business logics for getting anything done in this area, but saying only that so long as it's commercially viable, we will support, unfortunately, doesn't work in today's realpolitik. And it was interesting that he mentioned oil and gas might be put together with defense, perhaps, and NATO already has a department dealing with pipeline physical security and other issues, but we hope that there will be less need for such convergence in the foreseeable future, so that cooperation spirit will, or other measures of settlement could work better. And lake or sea issue, you may remember that the Iranians were about to sink one of the Azeri vessels in Caspian, feeling that they were out of what Azeris considered to be their territorial water. So there is a serious threat of hot confrontation on this issue. The Americans have a different view, if I understand correctly. They say that there is no way that the Russians and Iranians will consent to a constructive and peaceful settlement of Caspian legal dispute issues, so we should just simply go ahead, was one view I heard a couple of years back in Paris. And one point I want to make on this issue is that west of Caspian, we see that with Azerbaijan, Georgia, Turkey, more or less on one geopolitical camp, and where US and Europeans might make their influence felt strongly somehow. But east of Caspian, I see that competition there basically between Russia and China for the time being. And the influence of Washington or Brussels, no matter how many high-level visits are taking place, still limited there, because Russia continues to be a masterful player in that part of the world because of the sheer infrastructure, because of the significant political value of the hydrocarbon riches there, and also where it will be moving. So I think this needs to be made clear that west of Caspian, perhaps, there is more room for Western influence, whereas east of Caspian, difficulties are a lot, and I am not saying that it is impossible, but it is a region very difficult to handle. If I may say a few words about Turkey that John Roberts referred to, I don't think it's awkward. Turkey's position is quite clear, so putting my hat as a Turk perhaps right now, because if Turkey cares only for European energy security, of course it should be an obedient transit country. But Turkey has to consider its own energy supply security needs, as well as sort of flourishing partnership with Russia as well, because Russia replaced Germany as the main trading partner in import for Turkey. Defense cooperation, tourism, trade, construction business, and also remember that both Russians and Turks are relatively considered to be the others by the Europeans. And so long as Turkey is excluded from the European integration movement, full accession issue, and you shouldn't expect Turkey to have a very warm attitude towards ensuring European energy supply security. It has to care for its own national interest. On transit issues, it's not only transit, but Turkey itself, as I said, is the second largest client of Gazprom. And Turkey needs this gas supply for its own domestic needs as well, and before thinking about the well-being of the Europeans. Iraq is another factor which we haven't discussed perhaps, but there are significant developments in that front. If a sort of a modus vivendi could be engineered between Baghdad, Erbil and Ankara, and there is a possibility that Iraqi gas might be moving even before the Turkmen gas.
Good. Thank you. Anybody else want to intervene at this time before I open up the floor?
A couple of points. First of all, I think on the Turkey issue, I fundamentally agree with Mehmet. I think you cannot consider the issue of European energy security separately from that of Turkish membership of the EU. So long as the two seem to be in sync, which very roughly and difficultly they were up to 2004, there was a degree of congruence that was understood on both sides. If one had to blame anybody, I would be particularly critical of the Austrians for making it clear that they would only support the opening of Turkish negotiations kicking and screaming. And the result of that was that it turned the process very sour indeed. And the souring of that process, I think the Turks took, understandably, but I regret to say, wrongly, in the attitude that they decided then that they would loosen their cooperation with Europe on energy matters. And they have not actually managed to make it up by developing good cooperation with Russia. If they had, they'd be getting a lot more gas from Russia through Blue Stream than they are. What I think there is a problem concerns the big issue, which is what is the gas availability in Turkmenistan. We're waiting for the outcome of a study by Gaffney Klein. I think the real point is not that there is any problem with the overall volume. This is a country that has plenty of resources available in principle for supplying Russia, China, and even both the EU and the planned line to Pakistan and India, should the conditions in Afghanistan make that possible. What it lacks is an investment program, an attitude to foreign investment that would enable the gas to be developed, plus a question not so much of what are the overall volumes available, but where are they located? There are something like 4 or 5 major gas-producing regions in Turkmenistan. It's probably a safe bet to say that each one of those regions will produce a world-class export pipeline system, in addition to the gas already being produced and going to Russia. But the question is, what if any one of those 5 should not be capable of doing that? Does one area, customers to the west, customers to the east, customers to the north, or the south, suffer? So we have to wait to see not simply how much gas there is overall, but where it is located, and of course, what kind of investment regime there is. Lastly, a point that is a real bugbear for me. Who pays for energy security infrastructure? If you think, and you think logically, that you need energy security infrastructure as part of your national security, well, frankly, we don't, or at least we shouldn't, after the experience of the Americans in Iraq, turn to the commercial sector to provide security forces.